This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Audio recordings and then the ones after were properly recorded, but they never have much of an attendance. So Jazakumullah khair for showing up. I guarantee you won't, more than half of you will not be here at the end of the year, which is fine. The point of this for me is to put out a content that if later on you want to contemplate a specific idea and listen to it articulated or talked about, then it's available for you to do so. And I've done The Empty Space was one of the series, Towards a Modern Awakening is another series, and I did Facing Disbelief last year, which was the last series I did. This year we're going to do something called Reduced Concepts. And I'm going to start by quoting an Iraqi dentist and author, Ahmed Khayr Al-Umri. He put a post out in 2014, and I held on to this post for 10 years straight. And I just kept on reading it, and I discussed and I conversed with him over the concepts, and it led me down a long trail of reading. For the last 10 years, this what he said just made me really think, and it made me kind of go after the topic and kind of educating myself. And what he said was every civilizational demise, is preceded or paralleled by a reduction of the concepts and the values that help build that society or civilization to begin with. And right now, as Muslims, the assessment is that's where we are. We're at the point where a lot of our concepts, a lot of our golden values that the Sahaba radiallahu anhum learned and that transformed their lives have been reduced to skeletons of what they once were. And it's through acknowledging that, it's through understanding that we have a way back. Like, if you want to figure our way back from this mess as Muslims, honestly, it's a mess. If you want to figure our way back, then in my opinion, this is the way back. We have to start figuring out our steps backwards. What is it? How did we end up here? How did we end up in this situation where Islam is being reduced to rituals only, and ethics are reduced to an empty smile and some fake humbleness, and knowledge is reduced to a certificate that you hang on the wall? And a lot of these extremely important values are just reduced to something that doesn't really have substance to it anymore. It's there. You can see it. You can say that you're doing it, and that maybe others are as well, but it doesn't seem to have the impact or the effects that it had on people back then. When you read the Quran and you find Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala saying things like Inna salata tanha anil fahsha'i wal munkar, indeed prayer, it discourages and holds people and prevents people from falling into fahsha and into munkar. And then you stand there and you ask yourself, I've been doing this for 50 years or 40 or 30 or 10 years straight. I haven't missed a prayer in years. I don't understand. When is it going to start? When is it going to kick in? When is that going to start to where this ayah is going to be something that I can understand? And many people go throughout their entirety of their lives and they don't reach that because there's something missing. The concept of salah itself has been emptied from the substance that it once carried, and now what's left of it is just the mechanics of it. And this is something that if you take and you look at every Islamic concept. Now this topic, reduced concept, reduced values, is something that I can go on. It's not a 7-episode series. This could be easily a 50 or 60 episode series. Easily, wallahi. I'm going to just focus on the Islamic aspect of it. I'm just going to focus on the Islamic part. I'm not going to talk about I'm not going to go into a deep societal dive to see how a lot of our societal values and personal values have also been reduced, because they have. I'm going to poke out one or two of them that are relevant to us as Muslims today. But really the focus, the bulk of this series is going to focus on how our Islamic concepts have been reduced. And that, the goal of this is not to make you feel bad about yourself or to be pessimistic. And that's not the goal. The goal is to help you think about things differently. I want to help you learn how to think about stuff so that you can start recognizing concepts that have been reduced in your own life, so you can start correcting them and rectifying them, so you can trace your steps backwards and figure out exactly how did I arrive at this point. So this first episode today is more of an introduction, and the title is Moral Collapse and State Failure. And this is the title of a paper by Richard E. Blanton. It was published in 2020. Again, this topic has taken me down over the years. I've looked into it. I've had to read a lot on this. I'm not a sociologist or a psychiatrist or a psychologist. But this issue to me is very interesting because I felt it growing up as a kid. I felt that, you know, I can feel that the teachings of Islam are extremely profound, but I don't find it to be the case in my own life. Like I hear what the Sahaba say, hear what the scholars say. I'm listening to them talk about these things. It sounds to me that this is very profound. But then I look at the actual practice that I have and most people have around me. I don't see that profoundness. And how do we go from this to this? What happened? And then you find that, oh, this is actually not the first time this has happened. This happens all the time. This happens all the time. Moral collapse leads to societal failure, societal demise. It's been happening, yani, over the centuries, all across the world. This paper is worth, yani, if you care for academics, it's worth taking some time and reading. And I'm quoting it here because I did learn a lot from it, and it sent me in the directions of the different things that I ended up reading later on. I want you to think about this quote for a moment. Now, the collapse of civilizations or nations is preceded by a reduction of the profound values that built them. These values get reduced to either superficial rituals, meaningless practices, or corrupt ideas empty of substance. This is what ends up happening to those values. They slowly lose the filling. They lose the filling. They have nothing. They turn into a corrupt idea. They turn into a meaningless practice, a ritual that is just superficial, where you just do it because everyone else does it, but it doesn't really have that effect. These values built those societies. And what we're going to do over the course of the next week or over the next six days afterward, is I'm going to take Islamic ideas, some of them extremely core within Islam, and some of them maybe not as much, and just analyze them and talk about what they really represent, and how they should be practiced, and how they should be understood, and how we are understanding them, and how a little bit of a change of mentality and perspective, you know, can allow us to figure our way back to that. There are a lot of theories of societal collapse. If you look this topic up, there's a lot of theories surrounding it. Amongst those theories is climate change. Societies over history, some of them fell because of either the medieval warm period occurred or the little ice age that happened after it in the 1600s and 1700s. Sometimes a change of climate, of temperature, can actually affect a society. So there's a lot of theories. Amongst them is climate, which is I bring up here today, because that's something that I think we have more interest in discussing than probably any other generation that ever existed on this planet before us. There is a certain degree of uniqueness to the experience that we are having as Muslims, for sure, and as human beings, as a human race on this planet right now. And even though climate change has been a reason for societal collapse historically, I mean, this is stuff that you'll find in writings and the works of people that wrote books in the 1700s and 1800s. They talked about climate change, not as something that the human being was causing, but rather it occurring spontaneously and causing civilizations to fall due to the fact that they were not prepared to deal with the high temperatures or extremely low temperatures that they were not used to. So imagine now as people today, you know, we are inflicting this upon ourselves. Like we are actually influencing the temperatures on this planet to go up to the point where a lot of the living creatures cannot tolerate life anymore, including our own selves, and outside of the silos that we live here in the West, the bubble that we are nice and comfortable here in the West, a lot of people are finding it more and more difficult. They're finding it more and more difficult to actually survive in the world. Societal collapse. There are two aspects of the studies. I mean, when you look at some of the works that have been done regarding this issue over the years, they talk about causes and they talk about underlying causes. They talk about two things. Causes are things that are direct, like natural disasters and climate change and war or foreign invasion or economic depression. The economic system was flawed to begin with, and it was just a matter of time before it fell. I don't know if that rings a bell to you or not, or if you feel there's any relevance to that today. Or disease outbreak. Everyone knows about the famous famine that happened in Europe in the medieval ages, and it took millions of lives. Yeah, and until we figured out the concept of vaccinations and took care of smallpox and people the number of people that died in extremely young ages was very high, and the median life expectancy on Earth was very low. It was in the 30s and 40s until we came up with some of these solutions. So these were direct causes for societies to completely collapse. Now underlying causes are a little bit different. I mean, what led to it?
What really happened? These things were the tip over, the tipping point. Yeah, when you talk about a natural disaster or war, that was a tipping point. That's what exposed the weakness that existed in the society to begin with. The society had already fallen. It just needed something to expose it. So a famine comes along, or a war, or climate change, or a disaster of some sort. Something that happens and it tips over and shows and exposes the weakness of that civilization or that nation. But the underlying causes is what I'm interested to talk about. Because that's, I think, where we have influence as human beings today. We can actually change that. We have a say in these underlying causes. Maybe not all of them, but enough of them that I think this is worth talking about and discussing with you. So cognitive decline and lack of creativity. This is by far across the board. Everyone agrees with that. All of the sociologists historically, they differed on certain aspects of why societies would fall. They agreed on this one, the cognitive decline. And that's I'm giving you these ideas to show that the concept that I'm explaining to you is relevant. Today, I'm trying to prove, is a proof of concept. I'm trying to prove to you that reducing values causes societies to fail. Because if you believe that, maybe you already believe it, so you don't need to listen to all of this. But if you don't, or this is new to you as a concept, then I want to prove it to you. That once you have values and you reduce these concepts into something that is no longer meaningful, that causes, indirectly, over time, the fall and the demise of civilization. And that's, wallahu alam, why we fail. Like, why Muslims are where they are today and why they're not where they used to be. Why we don't have unity and we don't have strength and we don't have power or authority or autonomy or independence, or we don't have proper education or a good economic system or good educational system in our countries, and we don't have justice and we don't have fairness and we don't have a proper judicial system. The reason that this exists, my opinion, is from reduced values, right? And I want to prove that to you through the thoughts and ideas and quotes and conclusions that were made by people who studied nothing else in their lives but history, sociology, and human psychology. Social environmental dynamics and energy return on investment. So EROI, I had to learn what this meant over the course of the last couple of years. If you're not a sociologist, people don't talk about this very, very much. Sometimes economists talk about it. EROI is a big problem in the world today. So energy is what we require energy to run. Right now, if you look around you, the reason that we're able to do this is that a lot of energy is being used to fuel this laptop and this camera and to make sure the projector's working and make sure those fans and the air conditioners and all of this, is a lot of energy was put in. If the human race does not produce an equal amount of energy, then we're in an energy deficit, meaning we're using more than we're actually producing, which means if you have a finite source of energy, it's just a matter of time before you run into a collapse that is horrific. Because that will lead, because people don't have skill sets anymore to survive, and people get hungry. And then we run into a real problem. So EROI is a big issue today in the world, because we're talking about natural sources or clean sources of energy. What they're finding is when they're looking at the clean sources of energy that they don't actually meet a proper EROI. They don't do very well. Meaning they don't provide us the amount of energy that we need. We need fossil fuels to get there. We have not achieved an academic or a scientific level where we're able to actually use clean energy sources and give us the energy that we need. These are underlying causes for why societies collapse. I can't fix that problem. Maybe some of you are interested in studying this and will find a solution for our energy sources before we come to a point where we run out of fossil fuels or we burn this planet to a crisp. And then we turn into complete chaos. But what I think that we can talk about here today, over the next week, is the cognitive decline, the loss of creativity, the ability to think, and how to understand the perspective, the worldview, the attitudes. These aspects here are extremely, extremely important and worthy of contemplation. I'm going to start by talking about by Arnold Toynbee. So Toynbee is a very famous sociologist, and he wrote a book called A Study of History. It's 11 to 12 volumes. I did not read the whole thing, But I read enough of what he wrote to learn about his opinion regarding these issues. So what he said, that all civilizations pass through several distinct stages. He talked about genesis and then growth, in a time of trouble, then a universal state, a little plateau, and then disintegration. And most collapses, in his opinion, come from internal factors. So when he talks about this, and he's the first person, sociologist, not the first, because Ibn Khaldun talked about this before him, but I can't quote Ibn Khaldun for you properly because I don't have time to translate all of his Arabic stuff. So I'll just quote the people who wrote it in English, but Ibn Khaldun talked about this way before. So what his opinion was that this graph of kind of gradually going up, hitting a plateau, and then disintegrating afterwards happened by internal factors. It wasn't something external. He didn't see that the collapse of a civilization was going to come from a foreign invasion or war or natural disasters or whatever. It came from things that were happening internally. And he talks about during the disintegration, the society is divided into two. He calls them proletariat. He talks about an external one and an internal one. Meaning you have the society, it breaks down into two groups. A group that is in the know, the group that actually has the money and has the power, that 1% that keeps the status quo as is because it's serving their interests, and then the external, the group that has no idea what's going on, the group that is living on almost nothing. The amount, if you think about it, the most wealthy of us in this room, right, we're not amongst that group. We're not in that internal, we're not into that proletariat, that internal one. We're in the external one. We're not a part of the discussion of power. We're not a part of the discussion of authority. We don't move the world economy. We don't actually have a say in how countries behave. We don't have that. We're outside of that. And that's a big problem. The fact that Muslims aren't in the middle, or Muslim, practicing Muslims who have haqq or righteousness in their heart as something that they care for, is a big problem. Because if it's personal interest that's moving all of this stuff, then we're in real trouble. He talks about what people resort to. And I found it interesting, and I'm going to quote it for you for a moment. He talked about what people resort to when they're in the state of disintegration, when the society is falling, the civilization is declining. He talked about archaism, which is where people idealize the past and the dead. Sound familiar at all? Where we idolize the dead, and we idolize the past. The past was better. Everything about it was better. The zaytun, it tasted better. The lebana was whiter back then. The milk, it was fresher. People were kinder, the homes were sturdier, everything was better. If you speak to someone in their 60s, everything. Wallahi, the sun shined more back in the... Everything was better back in the past. This is called... This is the archaism. It's a very known societal phenomenon. When societies are falling and declining, we idolize the past. Everything in the past looks better, and it's always better. That wasn't... Think about the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's time. Do you think that's how they felt with him? That the past was better? You get what I mean? Like, because you can say, well, that's always been the case. Not really. No, not really. It wasn't always the case. There were times where the present was better than the past. In the future, they looked forward to something that was better than their past. And when they arrived at it, they celebrated it. It's normal for you to feel that I was better in the past. That's normal. That's normal. It's actually healthy for you to look back and say, I used to be pure. I used to be closer to Allah. And then you hold yourself accountable and you work hard. That's okay. That's fine. But for a society to see its past to be better than its present or its future, that's very concerning. And that's a sign of collapse. Futurism, or idealization of the future, which happens on the other side, or other groups do that. We may not feel that as much here, but the West sometimes feels that. The West today, they sometimes look at that. And you find pictures of how the human being is going to be half robot and flying to different planets. And even though the number of slums that exist within North America is equal to the number of slums that exist in Asia, there's no difference. There's the same number of slums, same amount of people who are living under the line of poverty, substance abuse, and these problems are as prevalent here as they are in other parts. But then you run away from that by just idealizing what's going to happen in the future. Detachment, where people remove themselves altogether. Is a problem that we have in our community, where Muslims just see that this Muslim society is not that functional, so I'll take a step back. I don't want to be a part of it. And it's hard to convince them, come back in. No, come back, this is your ummah, this is your nation. It's worth working on it. It's worth improving it. It can get better. For sure it can get better. But it's hard because people, they resort to detachment. And then the final piece, which I think is the most interesting, is transcendence, where they look for new insight or for a prophet. They look for something that is new. And that's what the Prophet, and I find that to be my parallel to what the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam said in the hadith of Abu Dawood, where he said, "Inna Allah yab'athu 'ala ra'si kulli 100 'amin man yujaddidu laha amra diniha." Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, every 100 years will send someone, along the way, a alim, a scholar, or a khalifa, somebody who will renew the deen for the nation, renew their understanding of it, kind of like revamp, just maybe. Get all the dust off again and just kind of get it all ready and put it up and make it visible to people again. And historically, we've always had people like that. Imam Shafi'i being one of the people that were quoted in the second century. And if you go follow along, there's actually Imam Suyuti. He goes back and he counts each 100 years, who he thinks was the person who did that for that generation. Ibn Taqiq al-Eid, rahmatullahi alayhi, being one of them. And it's very interesting that this is an Islamic concept, that every once in a while we need, it's like we get rusty and we need a little bit of a kind of a renewal. We have to revamp and kind of reassess things again. Not changing the deen, just going back and actually going back to what the deen was teaching. Because sometimes you go a little bit astray. The culture, your culture, or your biases, or your traditions, or your norms will pull you a little bit in a direction. You end up finding yourself in a territory where it's not really Islam anymore. It's something, it has some remnants of Islam. It's not really what it is. You have to find a way back again. So this concept that he pointed out, I find to be extremely irrelevant to us. Quigley, on the other hand, Carol Quigley, who wrote The Evolution of Civilization. This is an amazing book. This is a really, really good one. Not that long, it's worth reading. What he looked at, and this is something that I put up here just to give you I'm not going to talk about it, but I have to quote it at least once. Listen to what he says here. This is, social disintegration involves the metamorphosis of social instruments, which were set up to meet cultural needs, into institutions which serve their own interests at the expense of social needs. When you end up having institutions that don't serve the needs of the community anymore, they serve their own needs. Institutions that become focused on their own survival. The goal stops becoming taking care of the community. The goal becomes taking care of the institution. That's one of the hallmarks of decline of a civilization and society. This is what he's saying. So I didn't make this up. He said this. He looked at the world around him and said societies that were designed to meet the needs of a culture or of a group of people, when the society or civilization's is nose diving, they become institutions that. The Muslim Wellness Network. Its only purpose is to serve the community. The moment it doesn't, it does not need to exist anymore. This is just, this whole space and this place and this concept, this institution, this charity, is just a means of transportation to help take the community from A to B. The moment it stops doing that, it can be gotten rid of. There is no value in itself. The only value it carries is the value of what it offers the society. If it's not offers the community actual value, it has no innate value in itself. It has no innate value in itself as an institution. I'm not talking about fair spaces that are awqaf, that are endowed. I'm not talking about that. We always need fair spaces where people can come in and they can salli. That's different. I'm talking about institutions that are set up as charities and then ask people for money and then claim that this money is going to be used for the well-being of the community. We have to be careful of this. Because sociologists have looked at how societies decline, and they point out that that's what happened. And that's what I believe where we are. I truly believe that's our problem. I truly believe that institutions, Muslim institutions, see that they have, it's called institutional ego. Yeah? There's something called institutional ego, where the institution itself has an ego, where its survival matters. See, my survival as a person, it matters. If you try to take my life, I'm going to fight back. I want to live, just like you. All of us do. Institutions shouldn't have that. Institutions shouldn't have that if they're not serving a purpose. If they're serving a purpose, it's fine. But if they're not, they don't have an innate value in and of themselves. They don't. The only value they carry is whatever services they're offering the community that they're a part of. But if that stops being the case and people start channeling their own egos into the institution, then you end up having institutional egos, where the survival of the institution becomes the purpose instead of the mean. It's the mean to take care of the community. It's not a purpose in and of itself. It's not. I don't know how to explain this clearer. This is a big problem. Institutions have to go back and look at themselves. Is the goal that the institution survives, or is the goal that this institution offers services? And if it's not, then maybe it needs to change, or maybe it needs to go. Change is better than going, but something has to change. Something has to give. If this is not serving its purpose. But that's what he says. Institutions which serve their own interests at the expense of social needs. This is what Quigley pointed out. Sorokin, who's a Russian-American sociologist, he's probably the most interesting of the group. He died in 1968. He wrote Social and Cultural Dynamics. Again, an extremely interesting read for those of you who care about this. I'm not saying, you don't have to care about any of this stuff. I'm just quoting, I'm trying to prove a point for you, and then you don't have to ever look at this ever again if you don't want to. But if it's something that you care about and you're interested in, then these are good books to read. So for him, he pointed out something different. He looked at civilizations as cultural super systems. And his theory was the following, that all of these cultures and civilizations, they organized around specific principles, and that they would pass through these principles in a cyclical rhythm. There was a cyclical fashion for the passing through these principles. Experiencing regular downfalls, when one set of principles replaced, this is the former set of principles. So he would look at, this is how he sees civilizations, strong culture systems that have within them principles. But the problem is that this culture or this civilization goes through these principles in a cyclical manner. Like it goes up where the principles are held on to properly, and then it dips and the principles aren't cared for anymore. No one cares about them. And then someone comes back and it brings the culture, those values or those principles back to the public eye and back to be practiced appropriately, and then cyclically it falls down again. And unless that happens, then unless we're able to take a set of principles that don't work and replace them with ones that do, then the whole thing falls. And as Muslims, we don't need to actually replace our principles. We just have to go back to the authentic version of them. It's just going back to the authentic version of them, that's all. And that's, easier said than done for sure. It's easier said than done, I realize that. But I believe that this is where, as Muslims today, that are not we're not in governance, we don't rule countries, we don't have influence on the policies of countries. I'm not saying that we don't have influence on the policy of our own country, that's something that we should, but I'm talking about where there are Muslim majorities, we don't have influence on those countries. So what is it that we can do that can start bringing back our ummah, our nation, to a state of success and prosperity? Well, this is how you do it. Start recognizing the symptoms of the downfall and start working backwards. Start fixing. Let's go back. Let's see what salah meant back then. If it's not serving its purpose today and people are like, I've been praying for years, I feel nothing, and they stop doing it, well, let's see what it was before versus what it is now. And how do we get back to what it was? And once you do, then you've solved the problem. You've actually solved the problem. So Oswald Spengler, or Spengler, wrote the most controversial book within sociology or this concept of societal collapse historically. His book is the target of ongoing criticism and controversy, he wrote The Decline of the West. He wrote this a long time ago. I read this in Arabic because it was translated to Arabic, Tadahur al-Hadara al-Gharbiya. It was a non-hard copy book that I picked off a Basta for 15 lira in Al-Halbuni fi Sham. The guy almost gave it to me for free because no one ever bought this book. So I picked it up, I read this book, and it wasn't really to rub it into the West and the fact that they're declining. It was more listening to what he had, his theory of the winter of a civilization. It's winter. And I loved that. I thought that was very valuable. He doesn't see it as ending. He sees that there's mawasim. The civilizations go through seasons. There's summer, there's spring, and then there's their winter. And then if they figure a way, they can go back to their spring again. So he sees it as a motion, a cyclical motion more than a beginning and an end. And his conclusion in the book was that what you see when civilizations are in their winter is a disinclination of abstract thinking. That people stop having the ability to think abstractly. Abstractly, what he meant by abstract thinking, he's a German author. So Allahu A'lam, this book was written in German, I think. The English version is a very good read. It's a very good read. In Arabic, it's reasonable. The Allah yarhamu, the mutarjim was a very good mutarjim. But I think abstract means figurative. I think what he means by abstract is more figurative thinking. Yeah, when you lose figurative thinking, when everything is literal, when you don't have the capacity to draw a parallel, when you're not interested in doing that at all, then your values start to fall. Because a lot of the values that exist that build a civilization existed within a context of time and space. They had a context. Now we're in a different context. To make sure that these values are going to... Yes. Yes. Yeah. Sure. What do I do?
Be quiet. No, I can't do that. No, go ahead. Go. You can keep it. Yeah, that's fine.
All right. What was I thinking? Yeah. So when societies lack the ability to engage in figurative thought and abstract thought, then they don't have the capacity to draw analogies or parallels
from their original values and what they meant to what they're going to mean in the new context that they're living in. So what they end up doing is, because they are going to think only literally, they copy paste, and the copy paste ends up losing a lot of the substance on the way. Like it just drops out on within this copy pasting or copying and pasting method. So you need that abstract thing. You need people who are willing. That's why tajdid. That's why the Prophet ﷺ used that phrase. So come yujaddid laha amradiniha, will renew it. So they allows people to see what honesty and what haqq and what salah and what siyam and what this Islam, what jihad, what these terms are going to mean in the context that you're living in. So you can practice them. So you don't end up looking at them as something that is, it hurts me when I find people, young people, who look at Islamic concepts and think, yeah, well, whatever. Yeah, taqwa, sure. So, like, they don't, to them it means nothing. Like, it's a phrase that they've been bombarded by, you know, with by their parents for a long time, or they've listened to. They don't see any utility for it. They don't understand what it means. They never saw anyone do it and actually benefit from it. And for them, it's just something that they're stuck with, and they don't really respect it. And it hurts. You know, it's hurtful because they're so profound. These concepts, these values are so profound. These principles, like, they transformed a nation. They transformed people. When you look at how the Arab were before Islam and how they were 30 years after the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam passed away. So altogether, we're saying maybe around 40 to 50 years. So just in half a century, what they were, what they became. When you look at, I'm not talking about the political part. I'm talking about the people, the values and principles and the lifestyle and the way of life that people were living. It is almost, it's unrecognizable. It's impossible for you to look at these two groups and say that this is a descendant, yani, of this person with only one. Yani, this is just the grandson of this person over here. This is the grandson of Abu Bakr and Umar and Uthman, and this is how they're living in comparison to how their parents were living, and the practices of the society at that time. How did he make such a leap? I have no other word to describe it. It's such a leap, a civilizational leap that he was able to bring alayhi salatu wasalam within 50. He didn't see it, by the way. He was only around for 23 of them. Then he passed away. It was 25 years later that things, you know, hit that epitome or the pinnacle of the Islamic Khilafah, three continents at the time. There was universities and schools, and people were writing. The majority of people knew how to write, and they were translating the works of the Greeks and the Indians and the Africans and the Chinese, and they were learning from it and building upon it. And the scholars, yani, the scholars of hadith and tafsir and usul, were botanists and biologists and astronomers. How did we go from this to that? Well, exactly. It was built on values that were very powerful, that we've lost our ability to abstractly and figuratively understand what they meant then, so that we can draw a parallel for them to exist today. Don't worry, I'm almost done. Jared Diamond, he pointed out in his, he wrote something called "How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed." This is more of a modern book. It's very well written, and honestly, it has a lot of insight in it. I just want to quote this piece for you. He proposes five interconnected causes of collapse that may or may not reinforce one another. He talks about the ROI that I talked about before, that energy return, where you're using way more than you're actually producing, that can cause problems. The climate changes, diminishing support from friendly societies, hostile neighbors, and inappropriate attitudes towards change. Yeah. Again, some of this stuff we can influence, some of that we can't, but inappropriate attitudes towards change. He talks about that in some degree of depth. That as Muslims, or as people in general, if we don't tolerate the need to change our ways or change the way we look at things, then it's just a matter of time before we fall and collapse. And as Muslims, this is very important to us because we've been struggling with this for a long time. We've been struggling with the lack of ability to change. I remember when I first came, and I'm giving a really silly example, so this is not like an example that has any weight to it at all, because my life has been pretty silly in general. I'm not a part of anything that has any weight to it. When I came and I started the Quran program in LMM, you remember that for me, for the first 3 years, and no offense to any of the brothers who were there at the time, they're all close to me today, and we're all habayib, no problem. But back then it was a very different experience. Every time a kid would read Quran slightly loudly, there would always be someone who came in and said, "This is too." They would be upset that this is loud and it's chaotic, and they're shahayyat. They're not putting their shoes in the right place. Some people would get upset and fill their shoes in a bag and throw it in the garbage. And I've been in the dumpster twice behind LMM. Twice that I had to go into the dumpster and pick up and take out the shoes and put them back and ask the guy, "Please don't throw away their shoes." I understand, because it's an issue of change. The masjid was always quiet and nice, and now it's loud. And now they are children. They're running around. And they don't really have the adab or the etiquette of the masjid still. And they're the masjid sounds and looks and smells and feels a little bit different. And if you don't have that openness of attitude towards change, then you repel those who are trying to bring it forward. And it took a long time. It took four or five years of constant just ignoring that and just dealing with it and advising that maybe instead of coming in and yelling at them because they're loud, you're a hajji in your 70s. Put some shukalata in your pocket and come and offer the kid who's coming to the masjid and not going doing something else. Just give it, because a few years from now you'll want someone to come and fix things in the masjid when he's 18 and 20. But because you kicked him out when he was 6, he's not going to come back anymore. So it's a simple and silly example. But if you take it and you just look at, there's so many other venues of the same problem, of the lack of ability to change. And to maybe consider that maybe the way my parents were doing it, or maybe the way I was taught it was needed to be done, is not necessarily the right way to do it. I run a masjid, so people come up to me all the time, upset that I'm not doing things in this masjid the way they grew up and the way they're used to being done. Now, the respectful amongst them will just advise me. The other group will come and point out how wrong all of this is, and how I need to go and seek proper knowledge and get references to people to fix all of this, right? And for the sisters, so just so you know, weekly, I get asked why I don't have a curtain here. Weekly, every single week, just so you know how much I sacrifice for you. Just so you understand that on a weekly basis, I have to sit with brothers and explain to them, it's fine, it's not a problem. Is it bothering you? Yes, well then look at me, I'm prettier. Look here, don't look there. I've solved the problem for you. Just don't look back and you don't have an issue altogether. But I understand where this comes from. I understand. When I came here, also the change of culture, the change of society was difficult. The masjid function a little bit differently. You have an urge to want things to go back to the way they are. But that's not necessarily the right thing to do. It's a healthy, normal human function. It doesn't mean necessarily correct. Sometimes it's not correct. Sometimes the correct thing is that you change. Imagine if you feel that you are the golden standard of what Islam needs to be. The audacity of that, like the level of arrogance that I require to say that I am the golden standard, all of Islam has to meet my standard. You have to do exactly what I think is correct. Instead of me seeing myself that no, I continuously try to aspire to be a better Muslim and to meet the standard of the Prophet والسلام, and hold myself accountable for not doing that. But that requires an appropriate attitude towards change. Ibn Khaldun, the master, why did it do it? Why did it say? Khaldun Ibn, wallahi al-azim, I don't know what to do with this, okay. Ibn Khaldun, wallahi, the father of sociology. He is, and this is Toynbee, the guy that I talked about. Toynbee wrote in his book, he wrote about Prolemagina, which is what they call the Muqaddimah, the Tariq al-Kabir, what Ibn Khaldun wrote. He said, is absolutely the best book that has ever been written in the history of sociology. And these opinions, about what he did. All his work is translated to at least 15 different languages. All sociologists look at his work and say that was the work. That was the guy who broke the ice. That the guy who started speaking about human behavior collectively. Talked about state. Talked about a democratic form of existence. Talked about values. Talked about the way to hold on to power. Talked about governance of people. Talked about people's involvement. And in your lifetime, if at some point you find the time, you should definitely read his Muqaddimah. This is something that the West take care of his book way more than we do. Like, they have commentary upon his Muqaddimah. I have yet to see maybe two Muslim scholars who have written anything. Ibn Khaldun was, rahmatullah alayhi, he put forward an effort that is worthy. I want to quote this. قال عندما تنهار الدول أو إن الشعوب المقهورة تسوء أخلاقها عندما تنهار الدول ويكثر المنجمون والأفاقون والمتفقهون والانتهازيون وتعم الإشاعة وتطول المناظرات وتقصر البصيرة ويتشوش الفكر. This whole thing is proper. It's just this thing doesn't want to do it properly. He says that people who are oppressed, or people who don't have their freedom, or people who are living at a time where society is declining, what happens is that their ethics get bad. They lose their ethics. Their ethics start to get away from them, and what you start to see a lot of superstition. You start to see a lot of people who share misinformation and say things that are untrue. And you'll find a lot of opportunistic people who will come in and will use that ignorance and use that weakness and use that desperation to for their own agenda and to steer people in directions that serve themselves. And then you have a lot of rumors. And there's a lot of munadharat. People are always arguing, right? If this is the time for the next 5 days,
Facebook, poor Facebook, will have to put up with us arguing whether you can give zakat al-fitr wealth or not. Right? This is going to go on for the next 3 or 4 days. Maybe, last year someone did over 500 million posts were made about this issue. There. Every year, around this time, we start fighting. Nope, you have to give it burr and tahin and whatever. Nope, we can give it, and then we fight. We've been doing this for 700 years. It's almost now, at this point, we should make an Eid out of it. And we should celebrate, because it's a cultural thing now. We love doing this. وَتَقْصُرُ الْبَصِيرَةِ And there's no insight anymore. وَتَشَوُشُ الْفِكْرَ And the ability to think becomes confounded. It's not, you can't do it anymore. This is what I want to discuss with you over the next number of days. I want to discuss with you the effect that our values have on the state of our nation as a Muslim ummah. And that if we can get our values in line, if we can figure out a way to correct and fix our principles and our concepts and reclaim the narrative of what Islam actually is, how to understand it and then how to practice it, then I believe we have a way back. We can figure out a way to bring back what once was, or bring it back even better. Maybe even saying that is wrong. I don't think we want to bring back something that's gone. I think we want to bring back a concept that was gone. The concept of unity. You see, the Khilafah existed back then in a certain way. The people who fight to try and bring back that exact same model, in my opinion, is a form of archaism where we just want to replicate. We don't need, what we need is an abstract thought or a figurative thought where we recognize what the Khilafah was for us. It was a unified political representation for us. It was leadership. It was actual leadership. It was protection. These are the concepts that exist within what the Khilafah was. That's what we need back. We need to bring those concepts to clarity. And we have to say, how do we bring these back? In a context that works today within the geopolitical landscape that we're living in. Because to try and bring back what was, in a time where things have changed in so many different ways, like the world is so different than it was then, I think is, again, you're banging your head against the wall. You're not going to get anywhere. But maybe figure out what did you like, what do you love about the concept of the Khilafah? What do you love? You have to love something about that. There's something beautiful in the fact that we had, what was it? We were represented. Yeah? There was political, there was some degree of unity. Yeah? We had protection. You think what happened in Gaza over the last 6 months would have happened if there was even a small shred of that left. If there were someone who was willing to defend them, you think that would happen to them? 34,000 people murdered, the majority of them being women and children, with images that are coming, that are emerging in real time from people who are on the ground, not even from media outlets to say that, well, this media outlet is biased and this one is corrupt. And it's just from people who are standing there with their phones recording the tragedies that are occurring to this population of human beings. It wouldn't happen to them if we had some degree of protection. So yes, the concept of Khilafah is beautiful. It's not a Hizbi political issue. It's beautiful. The Prophet ﷺ started it. Who built the nation? Who made sure that there's going to be succession? Someone's going to pick it up after him. You see, the person who was going to rule after the Prophet ﷺ was called Khalifatu Rasulillah, the successor of the Prophet. And then when Umar came around, they said, okay, he is Khalifati Rasulillah, the successor of the successor of the Prophet. And then they sat back and said, no, this is going to end up ridiculous. They start to think in the future, well, after the 15th guy, this is going to be, maybe we come up with something different. So they said, we'll call him Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Prince of the Believers. He is the Khalifa, as in the successor of the successor. Someone, the caregiver, the caretaker, the steward, the person responsible for the well-being of people. What's beautiful about it? That representation, that unity, that protection, that identity. Okay, let's see, how can we bring that back today? I'm not going to talk about that in this series, because I have no pull on that at all. Nor do I believe any of you. Yet. This is directed towards my younger brothers and sisters specifically, this series. If you understand it, and it makes sense to you, and you start correcting and fixing the concepts that are corrupt in your own life, and you start reclaiming the narrative of what Islam is, as you make your way up the ladder of life and you come to the point, statistically speaking, one of the people here in this room will hold office. Statistically speaking, there's what, maybe 100 people in this room, something like that. Yeah? 1% of people, one of you will hold office somewhere. So you understand this stuff, then you can start talking about the bigger picture. You can talk about how we can also bring back something that we have lost as an ummah. We are thirsty for some degree of unity, some degree of... You remember when the Moroccans made it to the semi-finals? I've never seen a happier population in my life. Wallahi, come to the masjid, everyone's happy, and the people are taking pictures, and they're waving a flag they never knew existed to begin with. And everyone's celebrating, and people are sitting in front of the TV screaming and jumping up and down. It's a big deal. It's just a game. It's just a ball. Kick it, and that's it. I love it. I love the game. I don't act like I don't like it. Thanks to Basil, everyone knows that now. Where is it? But the idea is that, is that something worthy of celebration? Well, not really. But that's how thirsty this ummah is. Any form of unity, togetherness, anything. So if we're that thirsty, then that means we should start talking about, well, how do we bring some of this back? Let's start by the simple things. Let's start by understanding Islam appropriately, understanding what jihad means appropriately, understanding what salah and siyam and zakah and hajj, what they actually mean, what their concepts are, what chastity means, what these words actually indicate within our lives, what implications they have upon us. So they're not reduced to something that is meaningless, that doesn't serve a purpose. So that, because when the youth, when you give them a concept that doesn't mean anything, and they don't understand why it's important, they don't follow it. Youth are actually much more passionate, much more compassionate, and much more truthful than people my age are. If they see the light in something, they will commit to it way more than any of us can. But they had to see the light in it. And it hurts me when they are presented with a beautiful Islamic concept in a way that is so corrupt and so empty that they don't want it. However, had it been presented to them appropriately, they would have loved it. And they would have held on to it better than I would. And they would have led the way. They would have led the way. I wouldn't have to. We wouldn't have to keep on pulling them to salah. They would do it. They would push you because they saw the value of that concept. Imagine that. Imagine if we could make that transition. I believe that we can. My favorite the Islamic writer in the last maybe 150 years, Malik bin Nabi, rahmatullah alayh. A true forward thinker. He died in the 70s. I obviously was not around when he... Yes, I was not around when he was here. I'm not that old. I was not around when he passed away. And he wrote a book called Shuruf al-Nahda, The Conditions of an Uprising, or The Conditions of the Success of a State. It's a very short book. It's not big at all. I think it's translated to French. I don't know if it's translated to English. You must read this book at some point in your life. It's a very well-written book. He says, he doesn't say this in his book, but that book it talks about these concepts as well. But he says in something called Milad al-Mujtama, the Birth of a Society, which is another book that he wrote that's very beautiful. Says, لَا يُقَاسُ غِنَى الْمُجْتَمَعِ بِكَمِّيَّةِ مَا يَمْلِكُ مِنْ أَشْيَاءِ وَلَكِنْ بِمِقْدَارِ بَلْ مِقْدَارِ مَا فِيهِ مِنْ أَفْكَارِ The wealth, the richness of a society is not measured by how many things they, or how many possessions they have. How much capital, how much wealth, how many buildings, how many things. Is measured by how rich they are in ideas. How rich they are in ideas. I had this conversation a number of times, and recently with Brother Khalid, I was talking to him about this. I always ask the question about, like, you know, are you guys aware of how much debt is the United States in? What? 1 trillion? It's three, right? 30? There you go. Is it 30? I don't know. Is it 30 trillion? Is it that much? And it's even worse than I thought. I was happy with three. So when you look at the debt that they're in, you wonder how is it that they still, you know, basically run the world? Well, let me tell you from I'm a physician. The only time a guideline within medicine changes if it happens within the state. All of the big researchers, all of the people who write the medical guidelines and do the big trials are living in the state. And that's where they go. If you want to be a great physician, that's where you go. If that's where you want to run trials that are meaningful, that's where you go. That's what they have. They have all the minds. They have all the minds. People who are creative and want to make a difference. I lived in Syria. I would have probably stayed there if there was no war, honestly. But a part of me was like, I can only go so far here. Like, you're limited not just by the resources, you're limited also by the society. Like, community itself will limit your ability to think and to speak because they just lack so many tools. So you leave to a place where that's not the case. So even though they may be in debt, but they continue to have the power all across the globe because every discipline, not just medicine, that's where you go. If a paper is published in Japan about some chemotherapy that works, I don't care. I'm going to wait for it to come out of MD Anderson in Texas. or if Sloan Catering and Memorial. So they have to put out something. I have to see, they have to revise, they have to look at the trial and critique it and then give it to me. I can try and critique myself, but I need it to come from the experts who, because I know where who the experts are. I know the 10 experts in my field in genital urinary cancers, the people who treat with chemotherapy and targeted therapy and immunotherapies, all 10 of them, all in the field. If I want to go meet them and get to know them and have a mentor, I have to get on a plane and go to San Diego or Austin or somewhere to meet these people so I can learn from them. The wealth of a society is not money, even though we think it is. I'm not going to say something offensive to the Gulf, right? Because I love that place. I grew up there. But it's not about money. You can have a lot of money. But if you don't have ideas, if you're not rich in ideas, it doesn't mean anything. If you're not rich in value, and that's the richness of our deen. Think about the Prophet. Think about this. In a place where there are no rivers, it's ludicrous, wallahi. If you study history, it makes no sense. The evolution of Islam makes no sense. There's no river in the Middle East. There's no river. Every civilization existed around a river. The Euphrates, the Nile, the Amazon. There has to be a river because people still didn't have the tools to extract fresh water. So you're talking about a place where there's no fresh water. The fresh water is very scarce. There's actually no political governance at all. Arabia was the only part of that whole region that had no political governance. There was no king that ruled the whole place. There were small kings that were governing cities, just a city, like the Manazir al-Qasasina and Tubba. They just had cities, small areas. But Arabia, in the openness of its desert, was free land. You could do whatever you want. There was no law. If you murdered someone, that's it. If their family did not figure it out and come after you, there was no one going to pursue this. There was no law. There's no hand up. There's no law. People who were illiterate, they could not write and read. They were masters of their tongues, but they didn't write and read. He started alayhi salatu wasalam alone. He had no army. He had no wealth. He did not have wealthy followers, alayhi salatu wasalam. How he prevailed was through the strength of the idea, was the strength of the Quran. The Quran brought an idea that was powerful, that the people of Quraysh couldn't push back with their thoughts. They couldn't push back against the idea. They brought in propaganda. They brought in rumors. They took him to war. They tried to flex their wealth and their muscle with him, but they couldn't beat his idea. And he just persevered long enough for the better idea to win. Stronger ideas always prevail. They always do. They always win. A strong idea will always succeed. Always. Hands down. If the people carrying it will show enough grit and perseverance to make sure that it survives. If they just hold on to it and survive, better ideas work. We're not scared of having debates with non-Muslims or people outside of our faith. No problem. Bring. Say what you want. Whatever you want. Read what you want. My idea is stronger than yours. Not because it's my idea. It's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's word. So it's stronger than your idea. I'll beat you with the idea. Not because it's mine. It has nothing to do with me or you. It has to do with that it came from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we welcome it. Bring it on. If you have a better idea, we'll leave ours and we'll go to yours. That's what the Quran tells us to do. قُلْ هَاتُوا بُرْهَانَكُمْ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. Bring your Burhan, we'll follow you. But that requires us to go back and study the concepts that built this nation, understand the profoundness of them, and then take them upon ourselves. I'll end with that. Sorry for taking a little bit longer than I planned. Inshallah, tomorrow I'm going to try and make this the episode between 45 minutes and 50, and then I'll leave 10 minutes at the end of each session for a Q&A. This is the QR code. It's a one-time thing. Once you use it, you'll have access to the Google Sheet. You can put in whatever questions you would like to put in. I'm happy to take maybe two or three questions before we wrap up. But tomorrow I'll give maybe a bit more time for that at the end, inshallah. Subhanallah bihamdik. Shadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Wa sallallahu wa sallam wa barak ala nabiyyina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Jazakumullahu khair. Wa barakallahu fikum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh.